Okay, we want to. I want to show a video to you, as a lesson. You know, you know, one of the struggles of Chassidim today, because it's. One of the struggles of Chassidim today, is in our lingo. In our lingo, it's 20 years after Gimel Tammuz. Gimel Tammuz is the day the Rebbe passed away, and our struggle is to take those phenomenal lessons that we had the merit to learn. Which were astonishing, and you can also read them a little bit in my book here, The Secret of Chabad, which is not as good as Ron's book.
Fabulous.
Anyway, but and to learn from those lessons, and I want to show you now a video, and I want to tell you what this is, because you got to get this. This is the Rebbe and the Beauty Queen. Now that you wouldn't expect that. Every Sunday morning for the last 7-8 years of the Rebbe's life, he would stand in front of his office. And there would be lines of 4,000, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 people. And each person, anybody go to dollars by there? Anybody here? People would go to the Rebbe, and he would give you a dollar that you should give to charity to share a mitzvah with you. And he would give you a blessing. And if you were lucky, you could speak to him for about a minute or two. So when Bibi Netanyahu was the head of the opposition, he got 3 minutes by the Rebbe. Now, if he's prime minister, he'd get 5. But nevertheless, and thousands would come by every Sunday. Now, one Sunday, Miss Israel comes to the Rebbe. Now, when you think about it, what is an Israeli beauty queen coming to a Rebbe, and what is a Rebbe going to tell an Israeli beauty queen? And I want to look at this video. I want you to watch it carefully, because in this 1 minute video is Kol HaTorah Kuloi, the whole Torah, the whole lesson, the whole instruction, everything that we need to learn. Now, think about this moment here. It's astonishing. Yeah. A beauty queen, what do you imagine if a beauty queen turned up in Bnei Brak and said to some, you know, I'm here, Miss Israel. It's. I think that this video encapsulates the whole issue. Comes a beauty queen to the Rebbe Sunday morning, and she says to the Rebbe, I'm Miss Israel. She doesn't hide her identity. I'm Miss Israel. And he turns to her, and what is the first thing he does? First thing, he accepts her with love and care. The next thing he says to her, it's not just being nice. Now he gives her a message. What does Judaism tell us about what real beauty is? Beauty is not the superficial. It's the inner spiritual dimension in every single human being. It's your soul. It's your neshama. The Rebbe reaches into the very core of his neshama. Now, somebody who told me, who was there, that she started at this point, you can't really see it so much in the video, to cry a little bit. He reached into her neshama. Then he now that he's given her a message of Torah, which is the next important thing. In other words, we can be nice and we can be welcoming, but you can be also a person sitting in front of, you know, Denny's and welcome people for breakfast. But the next thing is you're giving them a message which is uplifting them. And without putting her down, he's sending her a tremendous message about what the true quality of beauty is. Then comes the next step. Then he calls her back and he says, you know what? You have the power to change other people's life. I am now giving you the responsibility to reach out to others. It's acceptance. It's teaching Torah. It's empowerment. It's transformational. And then the guy comes along who organizes the beauty queens. You brought the beautiful women. I mean, who would expect a Rebbe to say that? But here, I think that this little video encapsulates the whole essence of what we're trying to do, to love your fellow Jew as yourself, to care for other human beings, to teach them, uplift them with the teachings of Torah. In other words, not to water it down, which is to teach it as it is, and then to tell you that because you have been uplifted and you have been taught, you have the ability to change the life of another person. If you know Aleph, and if you don't know anything more than the first letter in the alphabet, Aleph, and the other person knows and doesn't know that, you can teach them Aleph. If you know Aleph, Bet, and Gimel, and they know Aleph and Bet, you can teach them Gimel. It's to empower everyone to be an agent for change. It's a phenomenal, and this, when you ask, why do we feel the way we do? We're not a bunch of robots. One of the things you get to know when you get to know the Chabad community, you go to any Chabad center in the world, everyone is different. I know we all have good cholent, etc., etc. And a good and the better Chabad houses like me have 18-year-old scotch, but nevertheless, not too much of it, just a little L'chaim. But seriously speaking, The Rebbe's teachings are very powerful, the ideas. And we have no monopoly on accomplishment. It's not because we were zeicha, we had the merit, we had the schus, that as we said, that we spent years sitting there and absorbing the richness of this tradition. We have no monopoly. The ideas that have empowered us have transformed the Jewish world. I would argue that other parts of the Orthodox world that are getting into outreach, it's all a product of this. My friend, Professor Arthur Hertzberg, who passed away some time ago, said the rest of the Jewish world is learning about outreach. It's basically borrowed it from the Rebbe. The point is that all of you can take the same basic principle, which is to put how you feel about, you know, when you look at another person, you can say, oh, this is the schlepper. You know, there's a guy in the back of the shul that all drives us all crazy. You know what the mitzvah of Avish Yisrael is? To love the guy you can't stand. It's to care about that person. Or to put the person in front of the institution, and to realize that you've got to move right away. I'll give you a little quick. Our federation sat down and they had this drove me a little crazy. There was money left over, so they said we should put it away next year for a scholarship fund for next year. I said there's Jewish children need to be educated this year. What are we waiting for? There's a sense of urgency. We need to move things. We need to do things. We can't sit on the sidelines. You say Yiddish, a fire brent. We have an opportunity at every moment to do something that can change the life of another person. So yesterday, I went together with the head of Chabad on campus to meet a senior official of the Jewish agency and to talk to him about some programs we could do together. So at the end of the meeting, you know, I'm sitting being corporate Lubavitch, and he turns to the guy and he says, I have to ask you a very important question. We're sitting at the Lynn Schusterman Foundation. He says, what's that? He says, would you like to put on tefillin? So this guy, I didn't do it. I learned my friend. He puts on tefillin with him. He does a mitzvah with him. So here is what the Rebbe is teaching us. Teach a word of Torah. At the very guts of who we are Jews. And we can't worry just about these broader communal things. We have to teach Jews Torah. We have to uplift them with spirituality. We have to give them something which is emes, something that comes from the deeper tradition that reaches back to Mount Sinai. And then we have to empower them to realize that even a beauty queen can empower other individuals with what the true quality of Judaism has to do. I think it's a beautiful video, but it encapsulates the whole thing.
That's beautiful. David is the Secretary of State.
Oh, please, whatever.
He is.
I have my own jet. I fly around. No. Has black hats on the beer. The flight attendants wear black hats. We also didn't know what to do, by the way.
But now, listen, we have this major session at the GA. People want to learn the secrets that we can use in our work. And I'll tell you what one of the secrets is. One of the secrets is the Chabad rabbi puts people first and builds relationships with the people. There is a reason Chabad raises. How much money a year?
We don't know exactly because it's not centralized. I guess between $1 billion and $2 billion. I don't know exactly.
It's not turn it on, it's a button on the
button.
Yeah,
year.
Okay. Probably.
Mute button.
Which one?
Testing. Oh. I would imagine somewhere between $1 billion and $1.5 billion. I don't know the exact number because we're decentralized. One of the big falsehoods is there's no big bank in Brooklyn that sends money all over the world. Each one of us is self-sufficient,
yeah,
which is the greatest miracle of all. In other words, we are supported by local Jewish communities.
Yeah, why?
I guess they see value in what we're doing.
Yeah, I want to tell you why. I think it's because, first of all, I have to tell you this. Almost all the money does not come from Orthodox Jews. The money comes from Reform, Conservative, unaffiliated Jews. Now, how can that be? That they raise almost as much money as the whole Federation system in a year, and they're not getting it from the Orthodox community. They're getting it from the so-called mainstream community. I think they get it because people are grateful for their relationship with the local Chabad rabbi and his family. Because when you meet a Chabad rabbi, within 5 minutes you're going to be invited to his home for Shabbos lunch or Shabbos dinner. You're not going to be invited to a program. You're going to be invited to a home. There's a reason that kids on college campuses, you mentioned it, Beth, say, oh, I'd rather go to the Chabad house than the Hillel. Why? It's a home. It's a family. It feels like home. It's not an institution. I love Hillel. Hillel is the second case study in relational Judaism. Hillel's doing magnificent work. But there's something about having this personal relationship with a rabbi who knows you, knows your story, cares about you, and is going to be there for you in good times and in bad times. I mean, my mother, God bless her soul, died 5 years ago in Omaha, Nebraska. Did my mother give a dollar to Mendel Katzman, the rabbi, Chabad rabbi, been there 28 years in Omaha? Never. Was Mendel at my mother's funeral? Did he come to the shiva? Absolutely. Knows everybody in town. Now, there's a reason that this happens. One reason is David's main point, which is if your mission, if your purpose is to meet as many people as you can and build a relationship with them to bring them to Torah and mitzvot, then that's your main job. Not building buildings and not building programs, that's your main job. And the second reason is that they have an unusual model. Their model is the exact opposite of our institutional model in the mainstream world. Take synagogues, for example. Join a synagogue, pay your dues, then maybe we'll engage you and care about you. Now, some of that's changing now. But their model, the Chabad model, is everything is free. Come, enjoy our hospitality. We'll find out about you. You'll find out about us. No dues, right? Well, guess what? It's not free. Because the Chabad local rabbi must raise his own money for his project. So it's not that they're building relationship with you because they want to raise money from you, but they do raise the money, and this is my point, because first comes the relationship, and then comes the ask for the money. Now, what does it mean for people in Federation life? One of my other case studies in relational Judaism are the best fundraisers in North America. Jerry Silverman, John Ruske, David Ellenson, Abe Foxman, and they all tell me the same thing. In this book, fundraising is friendraising. You get your biggest gifts from people who trust you and admire you and are in favor of the projects that you're doing. But the relationship comes first, not the ask. I mean, sometimes you give to a cause, fine. But it's only if you have a personal relationship with someone, and you guys who raise money for Federation know this, the biggest gifts come because you have a relationship with the person. A bottom line, what does this mean? It means they, the Chabad rabbi, has the privilege and the freedom to spend most of his time building these relationships. There's rarely a board of directors at a Chabad house. There are rarely committee meetings at a Chabad house. The Chabad rabbi and his family is spending their time doing their purpose and their mission. And so the bottom line for me, for a takeaway, for us in our work, professional or lay, is let's do a time study of how much time we spend developing programs we hope are going to engage people, as opposed to taking people out for lunch and for breakfast and for frozen yogurt and for coffee and getting to know them. I've said this now to rabbis all over North America. Do a time study, rabbi. Tell me how much time you're spending in administrating your synagogue as opposed to building these relationships. And I'm not talking about pastoral visits or a shiva visit or a Bikur Cholim visiting the sick. All that's important. I'm talking about just getting to know your people and then showing up for them. And one rabbi said 10%. One rabbi said 15%. You know, if we doubled that number, we would be more like the Chabad rabbis in terms of spending time building those relationships. And I think that that's really one major secret to take away from the Chabad experience.
I would put it instead of paying to pray, you pray and then you pay. But I also want to add one other thing. There's one other dynamic which is changing in American Jewish life, and I think this is important for federations, and I think everybody's seeing this around the country, is that I believe there's a new dynamic in modern American Jewish life that, as I think that many Jews are choosing who are not necessarily fully traditional, the old denominational divides are dropping. that's it. And people today are they really cross those denominational lines. And I see that in my Chabad center in Orange County, that maybe I had 300-400 people come Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, but I could count on two hands the people that came, you know, who walked the shul. The rest of them, let's say, did not come in a pedestrian fashion. Not that I wanted them to come that way, but that's the reality how they came. And what we're seeing now is another interesting changing dynamic, is mainstream American Jews today more and more. I was sitting yesterday with one of the senior, let's say, lay people in the Federation system yesterday. He says, my friends are going to Chabad and Salona in Ohio. It's so different, but they all want to go there. They're finding something. Is that we, a lot of Jews today, are making the choice that the place they're expressing their identity. Okay, I don't agree with the rabbi about everything. I know he has a mechitza. I'll live through that experience. You know, maybe I don't agree with all his philosophies, but that's where people want to go, or that's where they go part-time. I'm going to go to JLI on Sunday mornings, adult education. And so now we're seeing another shift in American Jewish life. I believe we're seeing the beginning of a realignment of American Jewry into three new blocks. On the right, I'm not being politically, I mean religiously, we'll have the Orthodox observant. On the other side, we're having the Reform and Conservative movements who are getting closer ideologically. They're not going to merge because there's a lot of institutions and a lot of buildings, and there's some differences. And the middle, the new evolving middle of traditional Jews in the United States is going to be, we have 900 and, I don't know exact number, 60, 70 Chabad centers in the United States. We have more Chabad centers than either Reform or Conservative temples. Well, they're not as big as, but nevertheless, we're seeing a new realignment. The Jewish life in Bozeman, Montana, and many other places, that the Jew chooses to go to Chabad. And they may not be fully observant, and we're willing to accept them on that mode. What is important for federations is that we have a big different attitude toward federations than other parts of the more traditional community. We see federation as a partner. In the 40 years that the Rebbe was a Rebbe, 42 years, the only letter he ever gave out to an outside organization to support was UJA New York, which is telling us that Federation does noble things on a global scale, and in my community, in Orange County community, Orange County, California, where the Federation and Chabad have become very integrated, where we've been treated not give me $18, but rather be part of the decision-making process, the Federation has gained tremendously because a lot of those lay people who are involved in Federation, we're emboldening their Jewish identity. We're strengthening their connection to Judaism. Then they want to do something. And to be very honest, what Rana said true. We don't got the boards and the committees. Shluchim are entrepreneurial. Our empowerment doesn't come from the local. We are here, number one, we're here for life. So we got problems with the local people. It's like a marriage. You go to counseling and you work it out. We're not leaving so quickly. We can't be fired unless it's done by our own regional structure. So we're here for the long haul. And we're working more as a partnership in an entrepreneurial partnership kind of model. And federations, if they realize the value, and it's a two-way street, by the way. A lot of times our guys and boys and girls can also be parochial in nature. Federations are smart. They're going to begin to see, you know what? I should involve the Chabad part into the system a little more. They're going to gain more. Because in the end, we're going to encourage Jews to be connected to Judaism. And if they want to give money to Federation and they want to support the causes of that, that's a great thing.
David, can I underline for you that he just said we're there for life? Do you get that? That when you're
I'm sick, actually applying for Beverly Hills, but I can't get in.
I know. No, but I want to tell you something. When you get an assignment in Chabad, you're expected to be in that community for life. Not. Contrast that with what happens in most of the rest of the Jewish world, where people are trying to gain the next biggest job or whatever. What does it mean? It means that if you're sent to Omaha, Nebraska, and you're there for 30, 40, 50 years, you're going to meet everybody. You're going to know everybody. You're not going to be here for 5 years and then gone. It's a brilliant insight that the Rebbe had to make that happen. Now, well. Look, and you know it in your own communities. You've had a federation director for 30, 40 years. That person really, I just saw Steve Nassiter the other night. He's been in Chicago. Everybody knows Steve. John Ruskay was how many years in New York? John knew everybody. A rabbi who serves a community for 30, 40 years knows everybody, and there's a great power in that secret of Chabad. To get somebody and make them so comfortable and so welcome in their community, they wouldn't think of moving someplace else.
Beth, Okay, I want to remind everyone, we gave out some cards. If you need some more paper, if you'd like to write down a question, we'll be happy to ask your question, and I'll pass some pens out. I want to just go back to something you said before. Yesterday, Jerry Silverman said we should stop drawing red lines about who's in and who's out in the Federation communities. And evidently, you know, there are issues in some communities
for
like
sure.
that. Chabad's outreach and welcome is the first call of order. But are there any red lines that Chabad draws?
We have one red line. And I want to tell you, I have to give credit to Jerry, because Jerry has worked very hard to be inclusive of Chabad in many ways. In fact, we went to Israel together about 2 weeks ago with a group of Jewish leaders. Jerry very much wanted me to join with it. And Jerry's made an extra effort to bring Chabad to be more involved in the Federation system. Our institutional line is one thing. It's a very important concept. It's halacha, Jewish law. We're not going to cross that line. And that's just basically because we believe, I don't believe in imposing anything, but at the same time, you know, I joke around with my guys. Every year, all the rabbis leave for the Chabad Shluchim Convention, which was this last weekend. I say, Chevra, please don't take that down Mechitza, you know, the division between the men and women over Shabbos while we're away. So the ladies say, don't worry, we're not letting the men do it. But at the end of the day, we struggle every single day with that nuance, because we believe, and this others may not agree, we believe in Jewish law, that it comes from Mount Sinai. We believe we have to hold true to our principles. And we struggle with this balance between openness and at the same time knowing when to cross the line. I'll tell you a quick little story. President Carter, he did at least one good thing when he was president. He went to the Hanukkah menorah lighting in front of the White House. And he's there in front of the White House. It's the fifth night of Hanukkah. It's the only time a president went to the Hanukkah menorah lighting. Vice President Biden came last year, I think it was. And he's there, and he turned, and it was during the Iranian hostage crisis. He was very depressed. He turns to Rabbi Shem Tov Sr., whose son now manages our affairs in Washington, and he says it was the fifth night of Hanukkah, and they were lighting a little menorah down below and this big menorah on top. So the president says to Rabbi Shem Tov, wouldn't it be better to light all 8 candles to bring more light in the world? And Rabbi Shem Tov at this point has a moral dilemma. It's the fifth night of Hanukkah, and the President of the United States wants all 8 candles, and he's saying to himself, Buzzel Ton. And I can get it's a rabbinic law, and Rabbi Shem Tov's a great scholar, and he's analyzing it. So he turns to President Carter, he says, Mr. President, and this is the precedent, you never president before came to a menorah lighting. He says, Mr. President, maybe we'll have a child light the menorah. So the kid goes and lights all 8 candles. And Rabbi Shem Tov sends in a report to the Rebbe, and he tells him, this is what happened. And the Rebbe said, I thought you would have had the Gaon Yaakov. I thought you would have the sense of pride and tradition that you would have told him no. In other words, when it comes to Torah, when it comes to halacha, I'm not saying I don't struggle with the issues. I struggle with issues of conversion. I struggle with issues of Jewish identity. Every single day, I struggle with the issues. But when the President of the United States wants to light 3 extra candles, the Rebbe told us, you have to have that sense of Gaon Yaakov, that inner, how would you say that in English, Monty? Gaon Yaakov, inner pride, inner strength to stand up to your principle. And by the way, I think that this is a great value. Because one of the things that people know when they walk into Chabad, as an old friend of mine used to say, is we don't move the goalposts. It's what you see is what you get. There is no religious committee. It's going to change the rules. We follow Jewish tradition, and that for us is our red line. And that sometimes can put us in conflict with others, but if you do it with care and concern, and you do it out of principle, not that you want to impose, I think people respect that.
Thank you. Okay, these are your questions now. Most shlichim are assigned to their community as newlyweds, and that means there's no mentorship for learning the trade of Chabad house administration and fundraising. How do these untested shlichim learn their trade?
Okay, first, they're not untested. People who grow up in our system start visiting and working in Chabad centers as they're growing up. They have brothers and they have sisters. We have regional conventions. We have national conferences. We have mentor programs. We have professional training. We have phenomenal amount of professional in-service. The game is, when I went out into shlichus, the world was, we didn't know what we're doing. We have email lists where the guys talk between themselves about What should I do with that guy driving me crazy in the third row? We have campus forums. We got 100 different email forums. If you're a shliach in Siberia, there's the Niberian Shluchim Forum, which talks about how thick should be your fur coat. And there's the campus forum and the teen forum and this. So we have a phenomenal amount of training going on. And one of the things that's happening is that right now we're doing a lot more folk, like the campus shluchim or the adult education. If I teach adult education, JLI, how many people here attend a JLI course somewhere around the country? I have to go to in-service. If I don't turn up that annual convention, they'll throw me out of the system. So we have a lot more going on than in the past.
I'd like to make a point quickly about Abraham and Sarah's tent in the Torah. You know the stories that Abraham is sitting in the entrance of his tent, and three strangers come by. It's Parshas Vayera. And what does Abraham do? He runs to greet the strangers. Does he know who they are? No. Does a Chabad guy know who he's talking to? No. But then what is Abraham? And by the way, Abraham was in a pretty bad shape at the beginning of the story, if you remember.
After the bris.
He had just circumcised himself at the age of 99. May I talk to the men in the room for a second? And it says, God appeared to him. I could be referring to the angels who show up, but it could be that God was in a relationship with Abraham. Abraham was talking to God or studying God's word. Nevertheless, strangers come by. Abraham runs to greet the strangers. And then he calls on his wife and the servant boy to help make a meal. Here's my point. A Chabad rabbi is not working alone. A Chabad rabbi has his wife and his kids. Now, some of our sensibilities may not be, you know, what are you talking about? But Rabbi Eliezeri told me, and a number of Chabad rabbis have said to me, my wife is a full partner in running this operation, and she's as important to the whole operation as anybody else. My kids have learned from birth to welcome people. The best thing that can happen to somebody in a Chabad family is to be appointed a shaliach. And frankly, from what I understand, there are not enough positions anymore. They're having sub-Chabad houses in various areas of the country. It's the Starbucks of Jewish life. But my point is this. It's the whole family. And one more point. I wanted you to know, those of you who are in Conservative Reform and other synagogues, that this can happen. Susie and I were with Rabbi David Seth Kirshner in Closter, New Jersey, just 3 weeks ago at his Shabbat dinner table. This man came to the synagogue 9 years ago, and in the first year, he insisted to his board to have a waitered and catered Shabbat meal on Friday night at his home. His wife works full time. He's a very busy rabbi. And the synagogue put a budget line in to support this Shabbat meal every week. In the first year David was in that synagogue, he had 400 people to his house for Shabbos dinner. Now it's 9 years later. Susie and I are guests in his home. It's a beautiful Shabbat dinner. There are 8 adults, 4 couples. Only two of the couples were members of the synagogue. The others were friends of the members who were invited to the rabbi's home. And I said to him, how now in 9 years, how many people have you had to your home for Shabbat dinner? Are you ready? 2,000. 9 years. And almost none of them get invited back twice. As opposed to many rabbis who are kind of taught, you know, have a small group of friends and they'll be your chevra. But they understand something, that when you open your home and you bring in people once, it has an enormous impact on your relationship as a professional, as a rabbi, to the people. And his synagogue has grown in a very competitive neighborhood from 600 households to 850 households in those 9 years. And he credits most of it to this hospitality that he and his wife offer, supported by the congregation itself. This is not rocket science, people. But it means that leadership, lay leadership, and the same thing would be true for a Federation executive or any of your executives. If we open our homes and bring people in, we have a better chance of building relationships with them.
Thank you. So I'm going to combine two questions because they're very similar. One is from a federation and one's from a Hillel, but they both ask the same question, which is there's a feeling of being threatened by Chabad, that when the other synagogues or other institutions in the community feel threatened by Chabad, how can the directors sort of bridge that gap? The Hillel example that I gave in the beginning is problematic for Hillel, that Chabad is seen as taking people from them.
So I want to say what's his name? Infeld. What's his first name?
Avraham
Infeld said a tremendous thing. When he took over Hillel, the previous philosophy of Hillel before Avraham Infeld, in my opinion, I was a campus rabbi with the Hillel at the University of Miami 30-some-odd years ago that tried to run me off the campus. I don't want to go into the whole story. You can read it in the book. I just took out the names of the players, but it was a very bitter story. When Avraham Infeld came in to run Hillel, I'm very always impressed with Avraham. He's an amazing man. He called in, he had a conference of Hillel directors, and he asked them a question. He says, what's your biggest problem on campus? They said, Chabad. He says, what percentage of people come to your Hillel? 20%. Or 30%. He says, your biggest problem is 70% are not walking in your front door. The point is like this. The truth is that we represent change, innovation, different ideas, and we also represent a greater degree of Jewish tradition in the Jewish mainstream. So you have over here, if you're smart, you say, you know what? Baruch Hashem, it's going to grow Judaism in this area. And let's be very honest. Not everybody who's going to come to Chabad, who's going to feel more connected to Judaism, the majority are not going to end up in Chabad. They're just not. They're not buying sheitlach and putting on black hats and beards. Let's get real. They're going to become more stronger in their Judaism, and they're going to go throughout the old community. So if you have a narrow parochial view, and by the way, this is a two-way street. Just as there's narrow parochial views in the non-Chabad or institutional world, there is narrow parochial views in the other parts of the institutional world. But those who are going to look a little bit deeper are going to say, okay, I got a little bit of competition. There'll be a little bit different approach. And there's going to be, and those who are mature about it, and they look at it this way, let's be very honest. 30% of American Jews went to shul on Yom Kippur. What are we being narish about? And I want to tell you what Jack Wertheimer wrote in commentary, that many people who belong to liberal congregations who go to Chabad for adult education, they come back more empowered into their own communities. So our job is to teach Judaism to people. They'll take what they want, and those who are going to be and if they're creative, and also there's something else. There's a lot of times we're locked into an institutional box for the last 40 years. I was in Venice in the end of August. I took my wife for a week to Italy. And in Venice, there's a structured community, and there's Chabad. You come to the shul, this community shul, there's a guard in front who gives you, questioning you before they let you in. And it's unbelievable. You got to go through an interrogation. And you go across the square in Venice to the Chabad house, and there's no room to get in the building, and there's 100 people standing on the outside. Now listen, maybe one can learn from the other. So a lot of times we're challenging old models of organizational behavior that have to be challenged. Some of the differences are real. There is differences between the liberal movements and traditional Judaism that Chabad represents. But there's also, one of the things that we were taught is that even the people that we disagree with, I want to tell you a cute little story. The chairman now of Chabad's educational arm, Rabbi Yehuda Krinsky, calls me up one day. There was a Chabad rabbi in a small area. I don't want to say where exactly it was. Somewhere in the north, in New England, in Massachusetts. And the reform rabbi got a Chabad rabbi there, and he was roid of him. You know what the word roid of means in Hebrew? He was trying to run the guy out of town. So Rabbi Krinsky calls me up. He says, listen, David, I need you to please take care of this problem, make a little, what's his name? Trulis try to intercede. And this reform rabbi, you know, he was the only rabbi in town, and the Chabad guy turned up, and people are coming to him, and he's all upset, and blah, blah, blah. And he says, please try to do this, and I'm getting all upset. This guy's out to get our guy. And he says, do me a favor. Don't forget that reform rabbi is Eichet Yid. He's also a Jew. In other words, you got to negotiate the problem, but don't forget that guy who is the cause of the problem, you have to have love and concern for him. It was a powerful lesson in my life.
Can I respond, please?
What?
I'd like to respond really quickly because you said something
Please use the microphone. We were taping in session.
So, hello, is this on?
Yes.
Yeah. I'm so happy to be here. My name is Sheila Katz. I'm the vice president of Hillel International. And I just want to start by apologizing for what happened to you. Sounds like 20 years ago.
It was 38 years ago.
I think we've come a long way.
It's a different world than then.
Yeah, and I feel like Hillel's come up many times. And the reason I wanted to come to the microphone is because I'm really proud right now of the relationship that Chabad and Hillel have together, including that Chabad came and spoke at our plenary session for all of our staff last year. And the example I'll give just really quickly is that Hillel recently changed our name to Hillel International, but for a long time we were called Hillel, the Foundation for Jewish Campus Life. And it was really important that we were called that foundation, not as in someone who gives away money, but a foundation for students, not the umbrella. And the reason we were never called the umbrella for campus, for Jewish campus life, is because of Chabad. Because we really see Chabad as a partner of ours. And if we're engaging students and meeting them, and Chabad is a better place for them to engage Jewishly, we are 100% going to make sure that those Jewish students have access.
And Eric Fingerhut deserves a lot of credit for this, but this is a siege, and this is a phenomenal. I give credit for Hillel, and I give credit particularly to Avram Infeld, who was the instigator of this change in fundamental attitude. And this is, and Hillel today, and when I'm Eric Fingerhut, I know there was some meeting at JFNA about problems in Israel on campus. So Eric Fingerhut insisted, where's the Chabad guys? We got to have them at the table. So I have to give great credit to Hillel that it is that the attitudes today around the country are phenomenally different, and there could be strong partners with us. I was at USC, where Chabad and Hillel put on together Shabbat 500. It was a massive success. They pulled their resources. Again, we got so much to do. Let's put away the Narishkeiten.
Yeah, so I would just say, like, I'm hearing a lot of almost like tension and putting Hillel and Chabad at odds, and that's just not how it is
today. No, I'm talking about 40 years ago.
Exactly, and so I just wanted to clarify. And then the question, I took the mic, so I'm curious. I'm curious.
She's good.
Thank you. You have to lean in. I'm curious how you measure success.
I measure success, you know, I measure success. Do I get a Jew to move ahead with their Judaism, to do another mitzvah, to learn Torah, and to connect Hashem? Because at the end of the day, you have the matrix. Did I get 27 people for this class? Did I get 150 for that class? But at the end of the day, I don't measure success about how many people walk in my building or how many people, I can show up on Kol Nidre night. To me, my job is to connect Jews to Judaism, to connect Jews to the Eibishter. Yiddish word Eibishter means to God, and to connect them to Torah. And every Jew, every time we do a mitzvah with another Jew, we connect that Jew, then we've accomplished. And that manifests in many different ways. For instance, I was in Israel 2 weeks ago, and I spent a day with a boy from our community who joined the Israeli army, and it was the last week or two, and I took him out to lunch. He knows all the great places in Jerusalem for specials. And I told him how proud I am of him that he served the Israeli army. And there's another person who went and joined the local board of the Federation. And the third one who decided to go study Torah and Yeshiva. You can't measure, everybody's an individual. And we have to value that individual and encourage them to grow in their own Yiddishkeit. And we got to encourage ourselves to grow in our own Judaism. Because we can't forget, just as much as we have to learn Torah with other Jews, we got to learn Torah with ourselves. And that's what my wife tells me all the time.
Sir.
Go to the microphone, please.
Yeah. So in my introduction, I mentioned that Beth Mann is brilliant, and I just want to share with you, she taught me a phrase that I live by, and I'd love all of you to live by. All boats rise with the tide.
There you go. And by the way, my little comment on this question is build relationships with each other. I mean, as professionals. You know, if the Chabad and Hillel leaders actually know each other and sit down and build a relationship with each other, I think we'd be in much better shape on these issues. So it's all about relationships.
I'll give you a classic example. My son opened up a Chabad center in Tustin, California, where I had a very strong conservative shul, and the rabbi there is Eli Spitz. So I was saying to myself, "Oi, Eli's going to get all nervous. He's going to get upset." Eli Spitz was a paramount mensch. And then after about, my son could be his son. After maybe a year, Eli became friendly with my son. He says, "You know, Shui, let's start learning together." So Shabbos afternoon, they live a block from each other, they learn together. And on Sunday night at the Shluchim Convention, we hosted Eli at our table. Now, Ellie could have said, oh, Chabad's opening in my neighborhood, I'm all worried, I'm all this, I'm all that. No, he said, you know what? They could do something positive. We built a personal relationship. I have my disagreements with Ellie. I mean, we can sometimes have our disagreements. But at the same time, that personal relationship, which Ron is talking about, has created a very positive feeling in the community. And people know that we maybe have different theological points, but we also have great respect for each other.
I want to ask, again, combined a few questions. You know, there's a saying, Im ein kemach ein Torah, right?
Yeah, right?
If you don't have the wherewithal, you can't have Torah. Mm-hmm. So philanthropy is a very important part of what we're all doing. How does Chabad ask for money? How do they cultivate donors? And when? When does that occur?
First thing it says, if ain't Torah, ain't, if the, it's a two-sided line. Right. If ain't kemach, ain't Torah. If there's no flour, there is no. But ain't Torah, if there's no Torah, ain't kemach, there's no money. Right. So I think the second part of the answer is the answer. I don't believe you can. I'll tell you a story. There was a guy in our community who was one of the largest philanthropists in Orange County Jewish community. And for years, I called him up, and he hung the phone up. He didn't want to talk to me. You know, he didn't like Chabad, I'm too religious, I'm too this, I'm too that, you know, all the kind of stereotypes, et cetera, et cetera. One day a friend of his told him, you got to meet with him. Okay, so I went to meet with the guy who was building a building. I walked in and I asked him for $50,000 for the building, and astonishingly he gave me the money. So a year later I called him up and I said, I need to see you again. He says, what do you need? He says, I need to see you. So I come to see him, he's figuring I'm going to solicit him. I said, you know something? I mean, this is the guy who was the chairman of the local foundation. He built the Jewish community campus. He was the chairman of the Eli Spitz's synagogue. He was the chairman of the building committee. I mean, the guy did everything in town. He says, well, okay, was willst du? What do you want from me? I said, you know something? You're a Jew, never learned Torah. You need to learn Torah. So I got him to come for the next 2-3 years to a monthly lunch and learn. Then he stopped coming. You can't, you have to give to get. At the end of the day, when you give a Jew Torah and you give a Jew Yiddishkeit, and especially when you learn Torah with a Jew, at that point it's transformational. So as you have to, first, I mean, there's always the question, and this is Beth, should I ask him, should I not ask him, should I pressure him, should I not pressure him? We all go through those anxieties. I got a guy who told me 6 weeks ago he's sending me a large check. He didn't send it to me. He's going to be back in town on this weekend. I'm wondering myself, do I call him today as I take a train to Philadelphia and kvetch him, or do I wait to see him on Friday, but I could use the money already. I ichtav him the geld. So, you know, there's always those inner tensions. But at the guts of the relationship is that you have to, I believe that learning Torah with a Jew, with another person, is transformational, that at the end of the day, what is Torah? It's chachmasa v'ratzoinish Hashem Yisbarach. It's God's will and God's wisdom. And when you connect a Jew with Torah, you connect a Jew with God, with Hashem, with God. And when you have that, then the person is going to see the value in giving. So again, what federations, you know, I'll give you an example about trips to Israel. We do missions to Israel. We're doing a big trip in March. We're taking maybe 700-800 people. There's not one solicitation on the trip. It's all about teaching the connection of Jews to the land of Israel. Later on, when they come back, the local rabbis will ask the people a few dollars. Federations take people, they take them to this place, that place, this place, which is all important, but the purpose is the solicitation. We're trying to cultivate the spiritual side of the Jew, and then he himself is going to know that he needs to give. It's not easy to do. It's like fundraising is a terribly difficult business. Everybody has a mishugas and idiosyncrasies, and it's just you can go crazy from the whole business. But at the same time, I think you have to give the Jew some spirituality, and then he'll give you the kemach.
So I think it's clear that personal connections.
But it's beyond that. It's beyond that.
And
has to be an element of Yiddishkeit. And this is what, see, federations are always afraid of too much God and too much, because they're going to offend that one, I'm going to offend this one. And yesterday I have to be honest, I'm sitting yesterday in the office of this, at the Lynn Schusterman Foundation with this guy who's a very high official in the Jewish agency, and maybe I've lost some of my Hasidic fervor, and my friend Rabbi Gordon, the head of Chabad on campus, turns to me and says, you know what Chabad rabbis are going to ask you at this point, and I'm looking at, because I didn't bring a pair. Were you put on tefillin? You have to connect with a mitzvah.
Hmm. So describe then how, if Chabad does use social media and online programs, and would that be, in this context, useful? Because
100%. First thing, the genius of social media is standing in the back of her, Mati Zeligson. who's directors of communications at Lubavitch World Headquarters, at Chabad.org, which is the largest Jewish presence on the, in the web, et cetera, et cetera. I want to tell you a funny story that happened to me. I see a friend of mine in Dallas before Rosh Hashanah. The Chabad rabbi who works with millennials in Dallas put on his Facebook page a short video comparing going to Chabad and going to the DMV. At the DMV, everybody comes. At Chabad, everybody comes. At the DMV, the furniture is miserable. At Chabad, it's beautiful. Anyway, I thought it was a great idea. So I put on I went to the DMV the day after Rosh Hashanah, and in front of the DMV, I did a video of me saying, what is the difference between Chabad and the DMV? Go to Yom Kippur. Anyway, he sends me a message, wow, you know, like, what did you do? You know, like, oh. I send a message, copying is the greatest, the copy is the greatest clause, et cetera, et cetera. Since then, I do a video every week now in the Torah portion, a one-minute video. We have to use, and when I use Facebook extensively, if a person has a birthday, I send him a birthday wish. But what do I tell him? I don't say him happy birthday. I tell him what the Rebbe taught us, that a birthday is a day of mazel and a day of spiritual opportunity, and you have to do a special mitzvah today. And I feel that Facebook and these kinds of medias are all great, phenomenal opportunities. We recently discovered a picture. What was it? Who's the guy who made Facebook?
Mark Zuckerberg
dancing 25 years ago at Chabad House in Harvard, at a Purim party. But as they say in Yiddish, it's garnish gehelfen. It hasn't helped us yet. Every medium in the world, and I'll tell you what's so beautiful about website, and I have to give a plug to Chabad.org, is that at 3 o'clock in the morning, when you're eating that Rocky Road, you're sitting in your pajamas and eating the Rocky Road ice cream, you could go on the website, and you can click and learn something about the Torah portion. So I think that we have to use every vehicle possible to bring more Torah to Jews.
This is the most amazing thing to me as an outside observer of Chabad. I was introduced to Mati a couple months ago, and of course he invited me to visit 770, the international headquarters of Chabad.
Tell him about the furniture.
The furniture is awful. One of the geniuses of Chabad is that they have been on the cutting edge of using the internet, of using social media. Muddy introduced me to the guy. There's one guy who full time is monitoring Facebook interactions, which is like 3 times more than any other Jewish organization in the world. The whole thing is cutting edge. Here's something that David hasn't said yet, that every institution in Jewish life ought to know and emulate. There are hundreds of Chabadniks who provide marketing materials on a password-protected website, so the local Chabad rabbi doesn't have to spend time developing slick marketing materials. Yep. He can just buy it from these Chabadniks who are spending their time building a business, providing the resources. Now, if the major movements in Jewish life in America had that kind of resource for their local people, we would be saving so much wasted time in developing.
It's not that smart of an idea. We have a website, which your official shia, you log into. It's called Shluchim Design Voice, and any graphic artist who produces something for a Chabad house puts up that postcard.
Right.
So when it comes to Pesach, I got 50 postcards to invite you to my Seder. You think I designed this fancy postcard. I paid a $50 change fee, and I look like, why doesn't everybody else do this? It's so simple.
We should.
Okay, I want to, want to have time to have a book signing in the end.
Yeah.
So please, quick questions.
We're from Federation of Orange County, the other Orange County in New York.
Oh.
And the small Orange County. And I just want to present an issue that speaks to a lot of the issues that you're talking about. And I agree with everything you say. Let me start out with that. So we have maybe 3,300 Jews. If we're lucky, 3,500 Jews. We have 8 synagogues because we're spread out. We have 4 Chabads. So the first Chabad comes 8 years ago, the largest. He won't talk to the other 3 Chabads. We want, as Federation,
I know all about your
together.
Problem.
I know you do.
I've been involved with it.
But it was 8 years ago that you were involved in it, okay? The one Chabad, we invite him to our synagogue when he first shows up, the first Chabad, to the Purim Carnival, and the rabbi finds him actively talking to the members and saying, I just opened up a Chabad, come. And the rabbi says, you can't do this. We're both Jews, we're both trying to do the same thing. And he hasn't stopped since then. Another Chabad, 6 a year later, we're doing Yom HaMesuot Festival in a camp. the camp is owned by Jews. It's their parnasa. And he's going around asking people to come to his camp. And I said, you can't do this. It's the man's parnasa. Please do it elsewhere. Now I finally have to throw him out. So, and then I'm trying to get, I'm dying to get all the Chabads together, all the rabbis together, and say, we're all in the same
game. We have an unfortunate situation in Orange County, California.
Let me just finish. The Chabads won't recognize the conservative and reform rabbis as rabbis. And so nobody will sit down with each other.
Okay, so let me first say,
I want everybody to be friends.
Okay, let me just say two things. Unfortunately, I know a lot about this problem. We, Baruch Hashem, you ever heard about politics in Jewish life? We have a unique problem in Orange County, California. We have an official shliach, and we have some other people that opened up, and they're not official shluchim.
Orange County, New York.
Orange County, New York. And those other that other institution is not officially recognized by us, so much so that our world headquarters has sent a letter to the local federation telling them that. So I can only speak that it's a very, I have tried to mediate the problem, have failed, and it's an unfortunate blemish on our institutions. Our position is that there is one official, our position from World Headquarters is there is one official shliach in that community, and that is the only representative of Chabad in that community, which is Rabbi Burstein.
So you're telling me as a Federation president, I should only invite the one Chabad?
I'm not telling you, no, I'm saying like this. There is many other, let me put this. I'm saying something different. There is an official shliach to that community, which is Rabbi Burstein. He is the representative of Lubavitch. There are other individuals in the community that maybe do good things, but they're not official representatives of the movement. We have a little bit of a political problem in that region of the world, and unfortunately, I have tried to mediate that one personally and failed sadly. And just like any other worldwide organization, we have some areas that we're not the most proud of. Sadly, I would say Orange County, New York is a tragedy. I'll talk to you more about it privately.
Yeah,
also,
let's.
A lot about that problem.
I think it's an important issue.
And we're not perfect. We have a little politics here and there.
I want to stress,
100%.
Absolutely. So federations, other institutions, it's not only with Chabad and synagogues that this happens. Part of our struggle as a community is to get everyone to work together cohesively and not just, everyone out making their own Shabbos. So we want to make Shabbat together. So let's close.
Okay.
And I'd like each of you to give us some parting thoughts about how we can take this back to our communities and focus.
So why don't I begin and let Reb David have the last word. This book came out 2 years ago. I researched Chabad as one of the case studies. I researched Hillel and their campus initiatives to get out of the building to build relationships with students in the dorms of the Greek houses that normally would not walk into a Hillel. And with huge success in Hillel, and social media efforts, and reaching out to young Jewish adults, and fundraisers, and so on and so on and so on. So I'm thrilled that the book has been helpful to Federation boards and to other institutions in the community, because it basically says, let's build relationships with people if we want to engage them in Jewish life. Because just doing programs or just depending on transactions, you give me dues and I give you a rabbi on call and high holiday seats or a membership in an organization, JCCs, and so it's not working the same. Reb David is absolutely right. The Pew study said, here you've got 89% of Jews who were surveyed said they're proud to be Jewish, but they're not joining our organizations in the same way. That, to me, is an opportunity. It's a challenge, but it's an opportunity. And all of us need to be on that page. So if this can be helpful to you with your boards and your leadership, by all means, I think it's important, whether it's my book or somebody else, be on the same page and use it for that purpose. And the second thing is, I think we need to learn to tell our stories. And I love Beth. And thank you, Beth, for doing this wonderful session. Let's give her a round of applause. I thank her for asking us to share our Chabad stories, because the truth is there's a power in telling our stories to each other. There's a great power in meeting the stranger and walking down these halls and not ignoring the other person made in the image of God and saying hi in the elevator. And when we're sitting and waiting for the plenary, to turn around to someone you don't know and say, hey, you know what? I'm Ron. I'm from Los Angeles. What's your name? Tell me your story. And that's the power of this new book I'm so excited about, The Best Boy in the United States of America. That's what my Zadie called me. He put me in a leg lock, and he'd give me a big, wet, sloppy kiss. I'm 8 years old, and he'd say, Ronnie, you're the best boy in the United States of America. And then my brother Bobby would jump into his lap, and Zadie would give him a big kiss, and he would say to him, Bobby, you're the best boy in the United States of America. And all, he runs all the regions of the Anti-Defamation League, Bob Wolfson. And the point of the book is, tell our stories, it's great power, and that's how we build relationships. And that's how we build a Jewish future. Thank you all for inviting me.
I want to tell you, it is a treasure to have a friendship with my friend Ron.
I love this
who is a Jew who's taught me many, many lessons. He's given me also sometimes on my head when I deserved it. But I just want to say one or two quick things, and I want to finish with a Hasidic story. First, I want to acknowledge one person who's here, Rabbi Eric Lankin. A little over 10 years ago, we thought of getting involved with Federation, and Eric was then working at then it was called United Jewish Communities, and he welcomed myself and the other Chabad rabbis in, and we were very skeptical of coming, et cetera, and it wasn't Eric, I wouldn't be sitting on this chair today, so you have to clarify. I wanted to say two things, and I want to tell you a story, which has to do with the plenary you're going to. The first thing is, we had a tremendous schus. We were able to have an interaction on a personal level, what I consider a once in a millennium figure who taught us Torah, taught us how to love our fellow Jew, taught us how to care for humanity, and took a bunch of very average people and got them to do very noble and great things. And we have no monopoly on that goodness. We have no monopoly on that truth. Because I happen to have that title. We were sitting about 3 weeks ago, I was with Jerry Silverman, with the heads of all the religious movements, sitting in in the Prime Minister's office, and they went around the table. This one said, I am the president of the Orthodox Union. I am the president of the conservative movement. Rick Jacobs says, I am the president of the reform movement. Deborah Waxman says, I am the president of the reconstructionist movement. Yeah. And I was sitting there and I said, I'm a Chabad shliach. Ich bin nur a Vorsteher from Rebbe. I am only the Rebbe shliach who was taught, that had this merit to be taught to teach, to care about other people. But I have no monopoly on this truth. And the truths that he taught us are truths that every Jew can use in their own lives. And each one of us, all he did was to tell Jews that you can accomplish so much more by caring about another Jew, by uplifting him, by teaching that other Jew Torah, and by being empowered to change the world. So that's the first thing I want to say. The second thing is federations, I think, around the country, who sometimes treat us fairly and equitably, and sometimes tolerate us, and sometimes give us lip service, and sometimes the other side is by our side also. Need to realize the change in Jewish life, that if we're involved with the Federation, we can make them a stronger and more viable organization. And now I want to finish the story, which is in my book. I only have a few copies here. Tragically, the shipping is coming at 1 o'clock this afternoon.
Wonderful.
The Secret
book.
Of Chabad, the world's most successful Jewish movement. But I want to tell you a story which is in this book, because you're soon going to hear Prime Minister Netanyahu. I also want to acknowledge my friend Rabbi Shem Tov. This is the rabbi who makes the White House kosher.
kitchen kosher.
And this is the son of the Rabbi Shem Tov, a story I told earlier. About in 2011, Prime Minister Netanyahu was speaking at the UN General Assembly. And at the UN General Assembly, he got up there and he told the story. He didn't tell the whole story. He said to everybody there at the UN General Assembly that many years ago, the Lubavitcher Rebbe told me that the UN is a place of darkness and my mission is to go into the UN and to bring light and tell the truth. There's a whole story that Simchas Torah night, many years earlier, he came to the Rebbe and there was 5,000 people there and the Rebbe spoke to him for 45 minutes, almost an hour, which was unprecedented. It was lahavdil, like the President of the United States would walk in for the State of the Union address and the whole country is watching as the President is talking to one guy for almost an hour. And he spoke to Bibi that night. So I called up a friend of mine in Israel who's passed away tragically last April, a very dear friend. Many of you know him. He wrote the book, The Prime Minister's, Yehud Avner, a wonderful human being, one of the great treasured friendships of my life. And I called him up and I said, Yehuda, what, you know, Yehuda, I'd call him up. He would say, ah, David, I'm so happy you called me. And I would say to him, Yehuda, you spent your life conferring. That means, you know, how do you say it in English? Being nice to kings and queens, and you're trying to be fancy to me. I said, no, Rabbi Yehuda, what's out there from the Drasha? What do you think about Bibi's speech? So he tells me all the pundits in Israel are saying that Bibi made this speech because he's what's his naming, because he's about to do something that Chabad in Israel is not going to like, and he figured he'll mention the Rebbe at the podium of the UN, he'll placate the community, they'll all be happy. So I said, what do you think is the truth? He says, call me after Yom Kippur. So I call him the day after Yom Kippur, 2 days after Yom Kippur, and I say, Nu Yehuda Vos Tutzach, what's going on? And he says to me, I went to Daven with Bibi on Yom Kippur. I said, oh, it's interesting. What happened? He said that Bibi was davening in a small shul in Rechavia. He couldn't go to the great synagogue, security issues. So I went to speak to him in the break. What do Jews do in the break? You sit in the front of the shul, you kibitz. The rabbi said such a miserable drusha, that this and this. So ambassador Avner goes to sit down with Netanyahu. He knows him for many years. He's a senior statesman. And he sits and schmoozes with him. And I said, what happened? He says, I finally got to the real question. And I turned to Bibi and I said to him, Bibi, al Rebbe dibarta. You talked about the Rebbe at the UN. So, and listen, even politicians can be honest on Yom Kippur afternoon. And Bibi turns to Yehuda, to the ambassador, and he says, Vadai dibarti al Rebbe, hu natan li ta shlichut shli b'chayim. He gave me my mission in life. The mission to tell truth in a place of darkness. This is a mission that every Jew has. Every Jew has the mission to bring light into a place of darkness. So a young diplomat was impacted on a Simchas Torah night, and he has his political things and everything like that. I don't want to talk about that. But something in his neshama was taught, was touched. Each one of us has that ability to bring more goodness and kindness into the world, to bring more Torah in the world, to bring more mitzvahs in the world. And if we do that, the world will be a better place. And that's our mission together. L'chaim.
So I just want to close, first of all, by thanking these two incredible people. And Beth, wait, before you leave, the secret of Chabad. Did you feel accepted here? Here, did you feel accepted? Did you feel uplifted in the message? Did you feel like you are now empowered to make a difference and be a change agent when you go home? And will you go home and transform others? Thank you all.
Thank you very much. Beth, it was okay.